This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
George Whitfield, very interesting character. Whitfield had been over in America on his preaching tour, had done an awesome job under the influence, obviously, of the Holy Spirit. And I don't know how many of you, we're not going to take time to talk much about Whitfield, but what an incredible individual in terms of how God used him. And he must have been quite something to listen to. And in terms of being able to preach to crowds, you know, 20 or 30,000 outdoors with no amplification, it's just quite something. And God used him in a mighty way, very effective, as he went up and down the East Coast several trips over to America. And of course, just as he and Wesley would be controversial figures in Britain, they were. Whitfield was very controversial in America. And there were many of the Congregationalists and Presbyterian clergy in New England, for example, that kind of looked down their noses at Whitfield a little bit. There are others that got on board with the revival and recognized that God was doing something there. But we're talking about the other side of the Atlantic and what happened in Britain. And the Methodist movement now is birthed, I guess, as a distinct and large group out of the awakening as it takes place under the preaching of Whitfield and Wesley. Well, Whitfield comes back to America after one of his trips. This is 1738, and he goes to a port city of Bristol, which is about 100 miles west of London. This was a city with booming trade, lots and lots of people there, infamous for its trade in slaves, African slaves coming into England. Of course, they were coming into the New World at this time. Also, it's a city of about 30,000, which is a significant city at this point in time. In addition to the shipping, coal mining was significant there. And so there was a rich class that were making a lot of money off the trade and mining, but also the poor. And a lot of immorality took place in the city also. And between 1738 and 1740, there had been a series of riots in Bristol. So there were some rowdy crowds in Bristol that Whitfield and Wesley are going to end up preaching to. Well, just like Wesley had been in Charles, John and Charles had been kept from many Anglican pulpits. Whitfield, same thing, found to be true. You know, he's also an ordained Anglican minister, but not able to get into many of the pulpits. They had heard about his exploits in America and heard him preach. Well, in 1739, Whitfield first preaches in the open air to 200 coal miners. 200 coal miners. Within 3 weeks, the crowds grew to about 10,000. And Whitfield is so overwhelmed here in Bristol, he calls, sends a message to his old friend in London, John Wesley, "Come and help me in Bristol. I cannot handle all of this." And so Wesley heeds that, and he responds. And again, pretty rough crowd they experience there in Bristol. Many are responding, and as some have pointed out, one of the ironies is the poor classes were those who responded in hordes to the awakening message, but it was these same folks of the lower classes that were so violent against the revival preacher. So, you know, love them or hate them, they're going to respond one way or the other. Here's a painting of Wesley facing one of the hostile crowds there in Bristol. And this was something that he just had to learn to deal with wherever he went, throwing rocks, bottles, whatever it might be to try to get him to shut up, but he would preach anyway. And so as these pulpits now are closed, Wesley too is going to go to open air preaching like his brother Whitfield had done. Wesley would not only preach throughout England, he became an itinerant revivalist preacher, if you would, preaching for conversion, for holiness of life in England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, throughout the British Isles. Wesley would travel, returning to the cities again and again and again to encourage the Methodist societies, the new converts, kept up a mountain of correspondence with individuals to encourage them. Wesley was real big on personal work as best he could, although a lot of that, you could imagine, was overwhelming, as everybody wanted to meet with Pastor Wesley. And that was not always possible, obviously. But look at some of the statistics there, and these are not exaggerations. These are conservative estimates based upon the different places that we know he visited and how many times he visited in his itinerant ministry. Probably preached over 40,000 sermons. Would not be odd for him to begin at daybreak and to preach three sermons a day. Traveled over 250,000 miles on horseback and formed these Methodist societies wherever converts were made, and he would get these folks organized, and then on returning trips, you see kind of an apostolic type ministry. People are converted, set up the ministry, go on to the next place, but then he would, like St. Paul, come back through again and see how the work is progressing. But Wesley, known for his good sermons, not as dramatic a preacher as Whitfield, but yet very effective, preached in the language of the common man. Both Wesley and Whitfield were known to make their sermons such that children could hear them and understand, and made a point of that. If I can't make the gospel clear and plain to these uneducated people that a young teenager couldn't understand it, then I'm not doing my job. And that's always one of the challenges. I don't know what you have experienced in your preaching and teaching, but you have to be sensitive to that. Wherever you are in terms of the educational level of your people and the concepts that they're going to understand. You certainly don't want to preach down to them, but Wesley was very sensitive to that, and it was part of the reason for his effectiveness. But to definitely preach not only for people to turn to Christ, but to preach the requirement of holiness, to follow God, and be done with this swearing and drinking and this ungodliness among you. And so a lot of the folks, were marginally or nominally, we might say, Anglican, and maybe had participated with the church on the margin. So they knew some of the Christian lingo. Some did and some didn't. But for those that were not truly converted, he sought to have them come face to face with the reality of what it meant to follow Christ, encouraging them to think through what it meant to follow Him in their life, in the factories, in the coal mines, and that kind of thing. As he preached God's grace for all, forming these little societies, trying to provide what he felt like the church was not giving them, and developed quite a network of lay assistants. And one of the things Wesley had to be careful about is he, throughout his life, had a lot of close contact with many women who led some of the Methodist societies, both in correspondence and discipleship relationships. And Wesley just felt like that was important to keep things going on. Well, you know how rumors spread. There's actually zero evidence that Wesley ever was guilty of impropriety in any way. But you can imagine how rumors spread about some of that, but there are no eyewitness testimonies to him doing anything that wasn't appropriate. But a lot of women involved in the Methodist renewal and leadership roles among the Methodists. One thing that's always impressed me about Wesley, a lot of people don't know this about them, but how he really led by example. He kept his meager income of 28 pounds a year the same his entire ministry. He never once took a raise from the amount that he was given from the very beginning. And his sustenance would have been below the poverty level by today's standards, but he all the money he made from books he gave away to the poor and lived a very austere life. And if you can imagine a Brit doing this, he actually gave up drinking tea because it's just too expensive to buy and it's wasting God's money. One of the groups that he really appreciated were the ancient monks, and particularly the Eastern Fathers, and some of his teaching about holiness and perfection that we're going to talk about a little bit, he obviously had imbibed from some of the Eastern Fathers. But one of the things that the Desert Fathers, for example, had emphasized is this whole issue. And I've often wondered if this is where Wesley was first, you know, kind of encountered these ideas as you look at his very austere life, is the Eastern monks talked about the fact that your goal in life is to live on as little as you can so you can give away as much as you can. This is the way God wants us to live. And Wesley certainly lived that out and was very consistent with that. So there's nothing opulent related to Wesley and his lifestyle. And I think that's part of the reason that people were drawn to him, as they could see he really was trying to live it out in this this area. Here we have Wesley preaching in Newgate Prison. He continued that prison ministry and going to the rough and tough and trying to take the gospel to them, something that had begun as a part of the ministry of the Fetter Lane Society. He continued there and wanted to see many of these prisoners come to know the Lord. Well, here is a painting from the era. And you'll note how they're poking fun at one of these Methodist meetings here. And you'll notice he's got a witch over here and devil over here, and got a couple carrying on over there. And it looks like they have almost kind of demonic things. You see that in the ornament? But this notion that these Methodists are all a bunch of fanatics. And that was the impression that many citizens had of them. Wesley was a master organizer and really put his ideas into play in terms of organizing the Methodist societies and then breaking them down into classes, into bands. Basically, after he would do his field preaching, and people would make a commitment, he would set up his basic organization, beginning with the society. And these new converts would be organized, and the numbers would get big, and then he'd break them down into the smaller categories. They would, typically, the Methodist societies would meet on Thursday evenings for prayer and for advice. These new converts, discipleship, if you would. And, you know, later and later there'd be hundreds of thousands of these Methodist societies around. The band, well, let me go to the class meeting. We'll do it kind of in the categories. The class meetings, now the societies could have large numbers of people in different communities. The class meetings broke the people down into groups of 12 each. And their purpose was to exercise discipline. In other words, to watch people's lives and to be sure that they are following the master. They would collect a weekly contribution for the work of the ministry and try to practice Christian community together. And the class leaders would go to the homes of the people at first as they had time, but then as things got bigger and bigger, we're not able to do that as much. And then the band was an even smaller group, which would have only about six people in it.
And now these were the small cells. They would be either exclusively men or exclusively women in these small groups of six, where they would provide pastoral care and encouragement and confessing their sins to one another, dealing with temptations. And so as the groups got smaller, more intense in their focus. So training in discipleship, exercise and discipline, and here more than personal confession among one another in male and female groups. And that kind of organization would carry over, I think, even to the Methodist societies. Now, in Bristol and later in London, they would have some large areas where they would meet. In Bristol, the foundry was bought by the Methodists and remodeled with planed benches there, and had a chapel in it with a gallery where 1,500 could come. So they had the public meeting areas where a large group could come. And this is where they would hand out medical supplies. They had a book room there where the Methodists could come and buy good literature to read, provided a school for children, shelter for widows. So the Methodists were known for really caring for people. And so that organizing themselves for the needs of people was a big part of that also. Now, Wesley, known for his publications, and he was real upfront about where he came from theologically. His magazine was called the Arminian Magazine. And published articles and things of interest in there.
When you consider, his journal articles, the pamphlets, published sermons, all that stuff, over 500 titles are attributed to John and Charles Wesley together. John with a vast majority of those. But they believed that putting literature in the hands of the people was very important for them. But I want to talk a little bit about Wesley the theologian. And the reason this is important, along the way we've kind of talked about the development of theological concepts as we looked at the Reformation era, kind of how the different Protestant branches developed some of their own ideology and thinking about the truths of the faith, the way they organize themselves, understanding of the sacraments. Let's talk about how Wesley came to define Methodist theology. Sometimes Methodists are kind of hard to pin down in terms of their theology. They have a book of discipline today, but Wesley's Notes on the New Testament is considered one of the important works of Wesley that more or less is a theological book that Wesleyans point to. I'll tell you who's done a lot of work on this is Thomas Oden. If you're interested in Wesley's theology, he has kind of plowed through a lot of Wesley's works. And Oden has written a little book called John Wesley the Theologian. It's one of the better ones I've seen, kind of an overview of Wesley's thinking. And Oden is now a retired Methodist scholar, very evangelical, but has wanted to help. Part of the passion of his life in the later years, especially, is he senses that the larger United Methodist movement, especially here in the United States, has gotten so far away from Wesley and his ideas that it's gotten more and more liberal, that he's wanted to draw their attention back to the fountainhead, if you would, and let's go back and really study and know Wesley himself. And a lot of evangelical Wesleyans, United Methodists, are hoping the church will turn back to some of the good stuff that Wesley produced, as it seems to have gotten away from much of it. Well, let me talk about Wesley the theologian. I want to talk about these different topics just a little bit this morning. I think you'll find this interesting because the overflow of Wesley's theology still permeates broader evangelicalism. Very much so. And I mentioned how large the Methodist movement would become in America, and it's the reason why so much of Wesleyan theology continues to be so popular. There are just so many people that have connections to that tradition. Well, let's begin and talk about his understanding of grace and this concept that we associate with him of prevenient grace. Now, the Latin word prevenio means to come before. And what Wesley was indicating here was this notion that God's grace must come first. This was a term that had been used in the ancient church all the way back to the time of St. Augustine. Being a good Anglican, he was familiar with the 39 Articles. And in Article 10 of the 39 Articles, where it talks about free will, it talks about the prevenient grace of God, that which comes before. So this is a traditional term, but Wesley is going to seek to highlight it as something that forever is associated with Methodist theology, if you would. Now, Wesley certainly would be put in the category of Arminian in terms of his basic theology, but Wesley considered himself more of a moderate Augustinian. If he would. He certainly didn't view himself as divorcing himself from the great heritage of Augustine and salvation by grace. But Wesley's nuance to the understanding the doctrine of grace is that he believed that God's prevenient grace comes to all men and women. God is gracious to all. He offers His grace. And it's this prevenient grace that prepares us. And then it puts us in a state where we can receive more grace, and then the sinner, though, can resist this grace. You can either receive it and act on it, or you can resist it. Now, he's not indicating that we initiate or create this first grace, if you would. God gives it. But then the human beings must respond to that. And then we receive further grace as we respond in faith. So Wesley talked about convicting grace, that is the knowledge of self as a sinner, leading us to repentance, justifying grace that calls us to trust the one who took sin upon himself, and sanctifying grace, our salvation brought to full moral faithfulness or holiness. So there are a lot of different aspects to Wesley's doctrine of grace, but this prevenient grace is primary for him. So every man has a certain measure of free will, and it can be restored to him by grace. And this prevenient grace comes, and then we must cooperate with that grace that we might receive salvation. Now, he's not Pelagian, and he certainly does believe in original sin. In fact, he wrote a little discourse on original sin. He recognized the reality of that, but he just believed that God's grace is offered broadly and given to everyone, which enables them to respond, and they either accept or reject that. And of course, this clearly lines up with the theology of Arminius back from the earlier period, and so you can see the connection here he has to Arminian theology. So grace then is universally present, and this makes us aware of the need we have to turn to Christ, but again, we may accept it or reject that. Now, Wesley actually comes up with the Methodist Society, some of his own articles of faith, and he actually further refined the 39 articles to 25 articles. And in those 25 articles, he actually cut out the article on predestination. He was not very fond of that one. I'm going to talk about that now and why Wesley. And to give Wesley credit, he really was what we think of as a classical Arminian in terms of his objections to predestination. And I want to read some of them for you so you'll see where he's coming from. And then I'm going to talk about how he and Whitfield eventually kind of got into it over the doctrine of predestination, much to the chagrin of Whitfield. He did not want to go there and felt like it wasn't a debate they needed to air publicly. Well, Wesley had an issue with what he perceived was a hyper-Augustinian view. At least that's from his perspective. And it became kind of a controversy in some of the Methodist societies because obviously, being good Anglicans, if you read the 39 Articles, it is Calvinist. It is. Article 17 is pretty straightforward on predestination. Wesley was not inclined to that, and he resisted this notion of unconditional election and reprobation. And he felt like this was a dangerous mistake. It endangers your soul. He even called it the very antidote of Methodism. So he was very agitated about this. And he understood God's foreknowledge as God knowing beforehand, his foresight, if you would, that is all of time is before him, that he knows those that are going to respond to him. Not a foreknowledge of ordination to life or to death in any kind of a Calvinist sense. So saving grace is offered freely to all. God in His sovereignty shares this mercy. And Wesley just did not like predestination at all. For him it was double or nothing, you know. And he could not accept reprobation, and therefore he could not accept the positive decree either. Now here are his arguments against predestination. See what you think about this. He said that, well, the reason I'm opposed to this rigid Augustinian doctrine is if we take that seriously, it will make preaching unnecessary. It even makes it absurd because everything's already decided. Secondly, he says, it will undermine holiness. The elect one may feel that he has no need to grow in holiness since it's already certain. And there you can read between the lines his belief that this would be an impediment to people growing in the faith. Thirdly, he says it tends to obstruct the consoling work of the Spirit, and it might lead to pride or to despair. It might increase one's coldness of heart toward those who you think may be excluded from grace. Fourthly, he says it tends to destroy the zeal for works of mercy. And why do good works at all if you're already elect? And he believed that it could lead to antinomianism, that is, a disregard for the law of God and the requirements that God has for holy living. If you're elect, why bother? Doesn't matter, it's already certain. Now, this is his caricature of Calvinism, if you would. Wesley also said it trivializes historical revelation because all is settled from the beginning. It's already decided. And on top of that, it's just bad exegesis, Wesley says. It ignores the text in the Bible which talk about God's universal love for sinners. And it ignores the full witness of the Scripture. God calls through the Scriptures all to respond, and He encourages decisions of faith. And then finally, someone embraces predestination, it can make one prone to blasphemy, making God a liar and Jesus a hypocrite, dangling salvation before all people, all the while knowing that only a few tiny group of the elect are going to be able to receive it. And other moral attributes of God are subverted, like His love, His mercy, His compassion. And it makes God a capricious tyrant, and damns before there's any chance to respond. All right? Not surprising, heard that before. And you continue to hear some of that same, you know, thing today, objections to a more strict Augustinian understanding of grace. But, you know, Wesley was actually passionate about this. It's one of those strange things that whenever you look at the debates about these things throughout the history of the church, it's usually on the side of those that object to the Pauline doctrine of predestination that really get agitated about this. And it often ends up being a debate about two things. This is going to increase lawlessness among God's people. They're not going to care. It doesn't matter if I live a holy life or not. And it's going to incline people to ignore the responsibility of evangelism. And you notice how you see both of those in Wesley. So very strong feelings about that. I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but before I talk about Whitfield's response to Wesley, because Whitfield would later respond to Wesley, and he would admit, you know, maybe I have been quiet too long. about this, but he really was trying to pacify the situation. Is Wesley's getting agitated about what he sees in some of the Methodist societies. All right, but let me mention something about his understanding of perseverance and how Wesley understood this, and see if you get a feel for this, because the Wesleyan Arminianism is noted for its questions about the possibility of losing one's salvation. Well, Wesley picked up, ironically, on the Augustinian language of faith working itself out by love. That passage in Galatians, I think chapter 5 it is, where Paul talks about faith working itself out by love. This is what Augustine had emphasized. And Wesley says, faith must be active in love. This is the sole condition of God fulfilling the covenant promise of salvation. And one can one annul the effects of sanctifying grace? And of justifying grace, can it be nullified? And Wesley answers, well, it's too simple to say yes or no to this. There are great difficulties there. Obviously, the covenant with Israel was conditional. And St. Paul talks about the shipwreck of faith. One must continue in the faith, says Wesley. There's no promise of God so unconditional that the response is irrelevant. So you've got to give Wesley credit here for trying to be biblical about this, for the severe warnings that you do find in the New Testament. The saint must continually rely upon grace so they will not forfeit the promise. Few are willing, though, says Wesley, to stay the course. And it's a long journey. Let me quote from Wesley. He says, to retain the grace of God is much more than to gain it. Hardly one in three does this. Now, Wesley had, you know, a pretty high standard in these Methodist societies as they examined one another's lives to see that people were truly converted. We must hold together salvation by grace through faith and the necessity of holiness. So he's trying again to put on the table his answer to the age-old dilemma, the relationship of justification and sanctification. Just never goes away, does it? Never does. None can finally be saved by any faith but that which worketh by love, both inward and outward holiness. So a perseverance of the saints was important to Wesley in terms of those who are truly saints will persevere, but as he says, God's covenant always has a conditional aspect to it. And if we truly are saved, then there's going to be ongoing evidence for that. Now, Whitfield is aware of Wesley's writings as he begins to put some of this in print, and hopes were that Wesley would not do this. I'll just mention a few of Wesley's sermons and little treatises on predestination, for example, if you want to ever follow up on looking at some of this. Here are some of his sermons. A sermon on free grace, a sermon entitled On Predestination, a sermon entitled Predestination Calmly Considered, to which I say, huh. You had some pretty strong feelings about this. Or how about this one? Dialogue between a predestinarian and his friend. Y'all, if I told y'all the story about the Wesleyan and Presbyterian that were talking one day about these things, you know, I never remember where I've said what. Comes with getting older. But they were talking together, looking intently at each other, arguing about this predestination thing, and they both kind of fell down the steps together and weren't watching what they were doing. And the Wesleyan says, "How clumsy of me." The Presbyterian says, "Man, I'm glad that's over." It is kind of a different perspective on life, and unfortunately he and Whitfield get into it. Well, during the years of Whitfield and Wesley's ministry together, they came to a difference over not only the doctrine of election or predestination, but also the extent of the atonement. Wesley tended to talk about a general atonement. Whitfield pleaded with John Wesley not to let this become an issue in their ministry. Why do this? And he asked him not to put anything in print about this. It will just cause controversy and stir up unnecessary distraction from the ministry that we have. But he did. Wesley published his sermon entitled Free Grace, and Whitfield held off for a long time. But finally, in 1740, he wrote Wesley a letter, and he said to him, For Christ's sake, let us not divide among ourselves. Let's avoid all disputation. Do not oblige me to preach against you. I would rather die. And one thing that stands out in their interaction is how much Whitfield loved Wesley. And even to the very end, he would not let it come between their friendship and their relationship as brothers in Christ. Well, as increasing harm and division was being brought by Wesley's insistence on his Arminian views, Whitfield responded with a letter to Wesley to refute his sermon. The letter was dated December 24, 1740. It's very evident in this letter how committed Whitfield was to the Reformed doctrines of grace, and yet how he was at the same time committed to his brother Wesley. And even Ian Murray, who's written some on this this little chapter in Whitfield's life, makes this observation. He says, "Doctrinal differences between believers should never lead to personal antagonism. Error must be opposed even when held by fellow members of Christ. But if that opposition cannot coexist with a true love for all the saints and a longing for their spiritual prosperity, then it does not glorify God nor promote the edification of the church." Now, that is a beautiful way to express that. It is incredibly difficult to live out. It is one of the greatest challenges that we have. And you probably, you know, as the controversy unfolded, things got a little difficult. Well, Whitfield opens his letter to Wesley. He says, "I frankly confess," because Wesley had, in the sermon on free grace, he had based his text on the Romans. He says, "I frankly confess that Jonah could not go with more reluctance against Nineveh than I now take up my pen in hand to write against you." But he says, Whitfield does, "I cannot stay neutral any longer. Perhaps I've been silent too long." And he chides Wesley for tempting God by casting lots. What Wesley had done, because Whitfield kept saying, "Don't do this, don't do this," Wesley had cast lots to see if God wanted him to publish his sermon or not. And so Whitfield says, "You're tempting God by doing this. Why in the world did you do this?" Because Wesley now claimed that through the casting of lots, God had told him he needed to do this. Whitfield tells Wesley it's unfortunate that he picks this text from Romans chapter 8, which so clearly teaches election. He says, "Has anyone a mind to prove the doctrine of election as well as a final perseverance? He could hardly wish for a text more fit for his purpose than the one you have chosen to disapprove of it." Well, Wesley's first point was that if there is election, then preaching is vain. You'll be saved or damned with or without preaching. Whitfield argues that God has appointed preaching of the Word as the means for bringing the gospel to the elect. God has declared not only the ends but the means. We do not know who the elect are, and so we preach to all, answers Whitfield. Secondly, Whitfield attacks the idea that election or reprobation tends to undermine holiness in life. Remember, they had both been a part of the Holy Club. And also the Fetter Lane. Whitfield had not been a part of the Fetter Lane Society, but he had been a part of that Holy Club. Whitfield says it is not the fear of hell that brings obedience in life, but it should be love and gratitude to God. Holiness is part of election. Wesley had also said that this doctrine takes away comfort and happiness, to which Whitfield responded, "But how does Mr. Wesley know this? Whoever believed election? As for my own part, this doctrine," that is, he says, "this doctrine of election is daily my support." Then Whitfield discusses the assurance of faith. That comes from a belief in God's electing everlasting love. Otherwise, every relapse into sin and surprise by temptation must throw him into doubts and fears. Then Whitfield takes up Wesley's comment. Wesley had made this statement: "How uncomfortable a thought is this, that thousands and millions of men, without any preceding offense or fault of theirs, were unchangeably doomed to everlasting burnings." Now that's a pretty stark statement there, and here's how Whitfield responds. "After Adam fell and his posterity in him, God might justly have passed them all by without saving anyone. If God could have passed them by all of them, then he might justly pass by some." Whitfield continues and affirms the absolute sovereignty of God, who is debtor to none and has the right to do what he will with his own and to dispense his favors to what objects he sees fit merely by his pleasure. And he gives a good illustration of God's justice in dealing with sin. Whitfield says, "As a righteous judge who takes no pleasure in condemning a criminal may yet justly command him to be executed, that law and justice may be satisfied, even though it be in his power to procure him a reprieve." And he also rebukes Wesley for his view of universal redemption. Whitfield ends the matter in his letter on a positive note, telling Wesley that he often envisions the day. Now catch this. He often envisions the day when Wesley will be filled with holy blessing before Christ in glory for opposing the divine sovereignty. And then he says, he closes the letter, "I love and honor you for his sake. And when I come to judgment, I will thank you before men and angels for what you under God have done for my soul." So notice his strong rebuttal to Wesley, but yet his charitable spirit. And it's said that as it became common knowledge that Wesley and Whitfield had entered into this public controversy over this topic, and it became divisive in the Methodist societies, that someone once asked Whitfield, said, "Do you think you will see Mr. Wesley in glory?" Maybe you've heard this before. And he said, "No, I don't think I will. Because he'll be so close to Christ, the light will blind me." And that's a great, I think, picture for us of the charity that we ought to have even in the midst of a controversy. Because you can tell from Wesley's language and even Whitfield's response, I mean, some pretty strong sensibilities along this line, but especially on Whitfield's side, wanting to maintain that that Christian charity. Because it was very evident to Whitfield, listen, God has used this man mightily, not only in my own life. You notice he said, "I'll thank God for what you've done for my life," in their fellowship as young men together. But he saw what he was doing as a part of the awakening. So he obviously knew God's hand was upon him, even though he vehemently disagreed with some of his writings. Well, Whitfield is not the only one that Wesley will have a falling out with. It also happened with the Moravians. And let me just mention that briefly before we take our break for coffee time. Remember we talked about the close relationship that Wesley had the Moravians, very enamored by them. One of the things he had done when he came back to England after he left Georgia and come back, he spent some time in Germany. He had actually gone to Herrnhut and spent time with the Moravians because he was so enamored with their experience of grace and of salvation, and he wanted to know more and learn from them. But he eventually has a falling out, though, with Zinzendorf and the Moravians because of some of their theology. One of the teachings that began to surface among the Moravians is this this notion that only God gives a true faith, and it must be a faith that is without all doubt. Well, Wesley had overseen the conversion of so many thousands of people. He knew that often people do not have 100% assurance. And do have some questions about whether truly converted or not. But the Moravians were teaching this, and were emphasizing a kind of what we sometimes call quietism, just that you sit and wait for God to give you true faith, that there's nothing you need to do in terms of outward works, and you can't even, pray. There's nothing you can do to earn this gift of faith, this absolute assurance. So you, in some of the Moravian meetings, they would just sit and be quiet, and they weren't even encouraged to read the Bible. Because, that you'll view that as a good work, that somehow you're earning this faith. Well, Wesley found some of this kind of odd, and he critiqued them for that. And Wesley's perspective was there are different degrees of faith. And I have seen some Christians that are weak in faith, others that are strong in faith. And I just cannot buy into this notion that once you get true faith, there's never any doubting anymore. And especially he didn't like this notion of people not applying themselves to the means of grace, of praying and reading Scripture to find further assurance of their faith. As the Moravians were saying, no, just sit quietly and wait for God to give you this absolute assurance. And also, Zinzendorf had begun to espouse the notion that holiness is something that can come to an individual instantaneously. And Wesley had an issue with that. And we'll talk about after the break his understanding of holiness or entire sanctification, but it's clearly progressive for John Wesley. And when Zinzendorf, again, just like this one-time experience of having absolute faith, he's also talking about this one-time experience of receiving full sanctification. Now, Wesley just could not buy that, and so he kind of cut himself off from the Moravians in close contact with them over those particular doctrines. So Wesley, had his controversy with others and right in the eye of the storm. But very bright man. That's one thing you need to know about Wesley. We talk about him preaching to the simple, to the poor, put it on the level of the common man. You don't have to read much of Wesley's stuff to realize this guy was brilliant. He was brilliant and a man who had clay feet, but a man who was filled with the Holy Spirit that God used mightily. It's just incredible, which is good for us Calvinist types to remember. It remains to be seen. Maybe he will blush. Maybe he already has blushed in the presence of Christ, as Whitfield suggested, because of his denial of sovereign grace, as Whitfield understood it. But certainly God did use this man. And I'm going to talk about a particular area of his life where Wesley had some significant problems, which is a real warning to us. So while I'm saying some good things about him that we should affirm, there's one particular area that was very problematic I want to talk about later also. Yes?
Earlier you mentioned the structure of Methodism. How much of that structure is still in place in today's Methodist Church?
Other than the annual conference, I don't know that the Methodist churches still use the divisions of societies, classes, and bands. There may be in some of the old Wesleyan churches. There's a whole group of denominations that emerged in the 19th century known as the Wesleyan churches. Some of them divided over slavery. Most of them divided over the holiness movement. Most of the mainstream Methodists tended to distance themselves from the holiness movement in the 19th century in America. But in some of the old Wesleyan churches, they may still, because they're so much connected into more primitive Wesleyan theology. But the United Methodist Church, as we know today, as far as I'm aware, they do not use, at least on any wide scale, this same kind of organizational structure. Now, if any of you are currently Methodists and know something different, please speak up. But I'm not aware of that. I had a cool thing. I'll just tell you this. We'll take a break. Being a history guy, I'm always interested in little historical tidbits. My great-great-uncle. It was the last of my grandfather's brothers died a few years ago. Before he died, he sent my mother a letter. And he proceeded to tell her the story about how I got my first name, Samuel. And my great-great-great-grandfather was a Methodist deacon down in South Georgia. And every Saturday night, a Methodist circuit rider spent the night in his home. He had a plantation, and so had a nice homestead there. And one night, when this Methodist circuit rider was staying there, his son was born. The Methodist circuit rider's name was Samuel Anthony. And in honor of that circuit rider, he named his son Samuel Anthony Fortson. My first name is Samuel. We have eight Samuel Fortsons in the family, all back to this Methodist circuit rider. So I will proudly claim a little Methodist blood in there somewhere. But you always find little interesting things you don't know. But one of the older generations doesn't tell you, it's buried forever. All right, well, let's take our coffee break.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.